Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. Tom Brokaw is our guest this hour, and Tom has written a book of a great deal of substance, not that his other books haven't been, but this book covers so much because he's been a terrific journalist for almost 50 years now, as he says. Where the heck does the time go? And so this book looks not only at many of the major events that have happened during his lifetime, but he also reflects on his parents' lifetimes and his grandparents' lifetime, his children's lifetimes. He looks at some of the major issues of our day and spends a great deal of time talking about the economy, talking about what happened with housing, looking at education in this country, who's doing better than we are and why. And it looks at this whole time of partisanship that we live in, because he's lived through different times, and I have for that matter as well. He writes early on in his brand new book, The Time of Our Lives, when he worked in Washington at the height of the Watergate scandal, an acrimonious time, his wife Meredith and Tom would find themselves at dinner parties with prominent Republicans and Democrats, people like Senators Bob Dole and George McGovern, two World War II veterans, opposite sides of the political spectrum, close friends, can you imagine that today, and often worked with each other on fighting global hunger. Tom's book is The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. He has, you know, probably a five-page long resume here. He's done some remarkable things. 21 years as the anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News, receiving all kinds of awards. He's done more than 30 documentaries on subjects ranging from race, AIDS, the war on terror, healthcare, Los Angeles gangs, Bill Gates, literacy, immigration, the evangelical movement. And he has done also a number of books. And we most prominently know about The Greatest Generation, and then he wrote a sequel to that as well. He's a regular contributor to the op-ed pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. He lives in New York and in Montana and has won every major award in broadcast journalism. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Tom Brokaw. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And you can also use our email, and that would be talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Tom Brokaw, hello. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Glad to be with you and listening to my biography. I'm exhausted already.
But I read your biography and I thought this would take the whole hour. If I read your biography, it's amazing what you've done, isn't it?
Well, you know, I grew up in working class South Dakota, and I always wanted to get out over the horizon and see bright lights, big city, and the entire world. And sometimes I think I overwished. I've just been very privileged to have the opportunities that I've had at NBC News and beyond, and it's very hard to say no, because it's everything is so exhilarating and so fulfilling in so many ways, and it's an exciting time and a challenging time right now to be a citizen, to be a journalist, to be a father, and in my case, a grandparent. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to share some of my feelings in this book, The Time of Our Lives.
You know, I really liked it, Tom, because there's so much substance to it. You take on the big issues, but you do it in this perspective of looking through the lens of your parents' eyes and your grandparents' eyes and this Midwestern sensibility, and have us reflect on what it was like for them and what it's like for your children and your grandchildren now. It just has this whole many-generation feel to it. And a lot of substance to it, which is good. I really liked it.
Well, that was the plan, was to try to be at once personal, but at the same time journalistic, and examining some of the policies that got us into trouble and some of the ways that we may be able to get back on the correct path again. The lessons of the past are always important. I'm 71 years old now, and I've been able to see this country go through a number of passages. And I don't remember a time, however, when there was such anxiety and lack of confidence in our major institutions. That's new to me. And the question that is really new as I go across America are parents and grandparents coming up and saying, do you think our children will have lives as good as we've had? That's always been a central part of the American dream, and it's rarely been asked in that fashion before, because the assumption has always been, yes, in fact, they will have better lives.
Right. And you outline that on a personal level so well in the book. You talk about how much money you paid for your very nice house in California when you and Meredith were, you know, fairly recently married, and you had a job and your house was worth about what your salary was. The whole part of what has happened with housing, what your children have to deal with in that regard, and also all of the people you interviewed who lost their jobs and were facing foreclosure and hit rock bottom.
You know, we kind of lost proportion. And I was one of those acquisitive people, too. I mean, I got to a point where I was making more money than I could have imagined, and I was constantly looking at, you know, I can just go buy that. I like to think I didn't lose complete control. But I know a lot of working-class, middle-class people were tempted by the instruments of mortgage that were put out there for them, interest only. You know, you don't have to pay anything on the principal for another 10, 15 years. And then they looked around at their neighbors and they thought, well, if they have that kind of a house, why can't I have it? In some instances, they just weren't equipped to have it financially. And then we lost sight of the importance of savings in this country. We now have a negative savings rate in America. I grew up at a time when my parents saved something out of every paycheck. Both of them worked. That was part of the, I suppose, the religiosity of the Midwest in that time.
Yes.
And we lost that, and we're paying a pretty big penalty for it now. And we have to figure out how we can kind of get back on even keel. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank has got a campaign going within their branches in which they have some young person kind of smiling into the camera, and the caption is, save is the new spend. So that tells you kind of how the corner that we've turned.
I keep asking this question, and there are a few people, and I was glad that you asked it in this book. You highlighted some people who made a whole lot of money and sort of had an epiphany at some point in their lives and decided, do I really need all of this? I'm going to give half of what I make, if not more, to do something for the good of human beings. Asking the question, how much is enough? And I know you've asked that, but talk about some of the people you highlighted in the book who asked that question and really changed their lives.
Well, there is I think probably the best intersection of those kinds of interests is in Atlanta, Georgia, where there's a man by the name of Tom Cousins, very successful commercial real estate developer, a leading citizen of the community in every sense of the word. I think he's fourth-generation Georgian. And he got to a stage in his life when he had a lot of money. He was always philanthropic. But he wanted to do something big. And so he went out to an area called East Lake, which had a historic golf course in the middle of it that had gone to seed. It was a golf course that Bobby Jones had played on. And what had grown up around it was what they called Vietnam, because it was a war zone of drugs and gangs and violence. I think the high school graduation rate was 5%.
Oh, my gosh.
And Tom went out there and had a big, bold idea. He said, I'm going to buy the golf course, renew it, sell memberships because it was a great golf course, use that money to go to the community and say, we can change the way you live. Community was very suspicious. Who is this white guy coming in? Was he just trying to exploit us? But once they caught on to what he was trying to do, they agreed. And so they now have mixed-income housing. It's like a model community. They built a charter school, named it after a prominent African-American physician who was very important in developing plasma back in the 1950s. They now have the highest math scores in the state of Georgia coming out of that school. There's a real sense of purpose of the people who live there. I've been down there. And when you have a community in which you have both working class and middle class, whatever the color, everybody lifts everybody else. Now, Tom is an exemplary figure in this, I think, a new trend of public and private partnerships. He was so successful and did it with such modesty that Warren Buffett called him up and said, I'm in, I'm your partner. And they're doing it in Indianapolis, they're doing it in New Orleans and Charlotte, next in Omaha. So that's a perfect example of somebody who saw a big challenge and took it on. Even though his friends said, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, he finally just said to them, I've lost a lot of money on your dumb ideas. I'm going to lose some on mine. And it's been very rewarding for him.
Yeah. You talk about covering the Olympics in Korea and looking at, it was sort of this, whoa, what's going on here moment for you. Right. When real early in the morning, all of these students are doing their homework before they go to school. They can't wait to get in the door, so they're doing in the dark.
It was as long ago as 1996. I was doing nightly news in the middle of the night because of the time difference overlooking a junior high courtyard. And before dawn every morning, the flashlights would click on in that courtyard and would be the students doing their homework, waiting for the doors to open in another 90 minutes. And these are the people that we're now competing against around the world. And when the president of Korea came to visit President Obama recently, President Obama, just making conversation, said, "What are your challenges in education?" And the president of Korea said, "The parents are demanding more, not less from me, and it's hard for us to meet their expectations." In this country, we've had a broken public education system for some time. I actually did a documentary in Milwaukee, the difference between the inner city schools and the schools in the largely white suburbs, and tried to find common ground between them and talked about the difficulties of doing that. It's not just the tax base. It's really about the purpose of the community. So we need to fix those things, because as we go into the 21st century, we're going to require everyone, not just white suburban school kids or people who are able to go to private schools. We're going to require everyone in the inner city as well to be equipped to work in the modern workplace and take their place in the global economy. And it can be done, but we have to step forward and get underway.
I know that issues of race have been important to you, and you've covered them in documentaries, and you've lived through some difficult times in this country in regard to that issue. When you were talking about education, I'm talking to you from downtown Milwaukee, and our children all went to MPS schools. But there is a huge difference, and I wonder how you take this on as a society. A, the schools are incredibly segregated. So Central City, Milwaukee are all black schools for the most part, or Hispanic schools. And then the suburbs are all white schools. Would you take on that issue? Does it, in a way, it seems like it's still kind of the segregated South in some ways.
Yeah, in many ways, it's less about race than it is about socioeconomic status and poverty. So many of the inner city kids go to school in the morning having not seen their parent before they left. Mm. They're single parents at home, and they're working earlier, two jobs. I'm in Birmingham, Alabama.
I know you are. I wanted to ask you about that. Alabama, what are you doing there, sir?
Well, I'm down here because of the book. And
wow.
I'm talking to a lot of folks. And here's a perfect example of a city that absolutely dramatically changed itself, and it wasn't easy. But the civic leaders and the other pieces of the community decided after the 1960s, when this was called Bombingham, when they were bombing churches and killing young African-American girls at Sunday school, that they were going to change the city. It wasn't easy. I was just at a local television station this morning. All the anchors on the air were women, and one of them was an African-American woman. Mm. When I was covering Birmingham back in the 60s, I could not have imagined that kind of a transition. So it's that kind of thing that we have to address. And what's most encouraging to me is that education now is on the agenda. People are paying attention. Michelle Rhee, who has gotten a lot of deserved publicity for her take no prisoner style when she was running the Washington, D.C. school system, actually had what she called capital gains. She was paying students for doing well and teaching them how to manage their money. Some people said, oh, you can't pay students to go to school. Well, it does happen in more affluent neighborhoods. If you get good grades, you get a little reward for it. So we've got to find a way that we lift everyone. The rising tide lifts all boats.
Right, we do. Because what else are you going to do with your life? You know, you wish you could live in reverse in some ways, don't you? I'm sure you're astounded to know that you're 71 years old now, and you've seen the world, and you have all this wisdom. If you could just let everybody know it goes by in a hurry, you may as well do something important. You got to go to school. You've got to learn.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I'm now at an age and stage when I can make choices, and I think I've learned something over 50 years. People still say that they're willing to listen to me. I should take advantage of that, I think, because I care about my grandchildren.
Right.
I care about the world that they're going to inherit.
Yeah.
You know, they've kind of won the lottery. They have excellent parents who are well-schooled and care about their schooling, but that doesn't assure them that they're going to be able to have the kind of quality of life that I think that they deserve. And back to that question about, will our children have better lives, I think we've got to get away from the quantitative aspect of that and not think just about, will they make more money or have a bigger house or more cars or more toys, but we need to make it a qualitative question. Will there be more economic justice in America? Will there be equal opportunity in education? Because that's how we're going to advance the nation, and it's always been the case. Mm-hmm. So we need to think about it again.
There are a lot of people, Tom, as you well know, who believe that nobody who they have elected cares about what you just talked about. They care about holding on to heavens knows what it is, but they won't sit down and talk to each other. The numbers for approval of members of Congress is at an incredibly all-time low. What the heck is going on? Why can't people in Washington look at education, look at the number of people who are unemployed in this country, and take on these issues, forget what their partisan persuasion
is? Well, I'm afraid what's happened just across the board in politics is that everybody is feeling hostage to narrower and narrower interests, and that drives them. It's because the money is propping up a lot of those interests. That becomes a litmus test. The blogosphere can create a kind of jihad against somebody who doesn't vote exactly on any specific issue the way the some of the bloggers think that they should. So it's left to the rest of us to say, hold on a moment. You're supposed to represent all of us here. I can't remember a time when the confidence in Washington was so low. In fact, as I go across the country, and I do that pretty constantly, there's kind of a dismissal of Washington. They feel walled off, so they're concentrating on their local communities to get things done and local leadership. And there is a, if not a bipartisan spirit, at least an understanding that to get through day-to-day, the Republican banker has to work with a Democrat who happens to be a backhoe operator, or the car dealer has to work with a Mexican-American immigrant who's working at the food processing plant. So they get that done. It's in Washington that they've retreated to the far corners and are constantly just yelling at each other. We have big, big issues to address. There's been very little in the Republican debates, for example, and certainly almost no dialogue on the Democratic side about the housing crisis in America. 20 million homes are either in foreclosure or in peril of going into foreclosure, and we can't have an economic recovery completely until we begin to resolve that question.
Tom Brokaw is our guest this hour, and we're going to welcome phone calls for him. He has a wonderful new book that looks at the heart of what we're facing right now, families, education, excessive partisanship, the best of the past that maybe we need to remember now so that we can move ahead into a more glorious future, and our children and grandchildren can do so as well. The book is The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address, you can use that if you don't want to do a phone, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tom Brokaw is our guest, and we go to phone calls for him, starting with Kelly in River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Well, good morning, Mr. Brokaw. I have a great reverence for the press. I think it's a vital instrument in having a democracy if we're going to have an informed public. But I want to go to the media feeding frenzy that seems to happen over major events, and I want to take you back to one you were involved in, and that was the Richard Jewell case, where the press got it wrong.
And what is that case, Kelly?
Richard Jewell was the man who was initially identified by the FBI as a person of interest in the bombing in Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
During the Olympics, and you're quite right. In fact, he was not well served by us, but we were relying on the information that we were getting from the very senior investigators in that case, and he ended up getting a fair amount of cash as a result of settlements with the various news agencies. So that was something that was not a great moment in my professional career, but I had talked to before I went on the air, and I want to remind you of something. I also said he remains only a person of interest, not a suspect, at the conclusion, but I said I'd never seen a case get this far, because they were not arresting him, and they were not leading us away from him. So that's what happened in that case.
I saw with the 10th anniversary of September 11, I saw you on, it was just captivating to me that morning when you were called into the station, and I thought, you were wonderful on that day. You really knew what you were talking about, and I found myself just wanting to listen to you say what you said that day over again. Because you drew on your experience and your knowledge. It's hard work to be a really good journalist, Tom, don't you think? I mean, it's not something that you have to remember things. You have to know your history. You have to tie events together. You have to know what you're talking about.
You know, that was a time when I said later that it took everything that I knew as a journalist, as a citizen, as a father, and as a grandfather to get through the day. I recognized immediately that this was an act of war and said so on the air.
Yes.
And then in the early afternoon, I said, this is going to change this country. We've been attacked, and we'll be going to war. And I was trying to imagine what the economic consequences would be as well. I later wrote that in the New York Times. About you know the challenge to the country to everyone step forward and understand that we are now living in a much, much different environment in this country. And at the beginning, there was, I think, a real unity of spirit in the country, but we lost it. And I think that President Bush didn't capitalize on what could have been a great opportunity for him to pull the country together and remind the 99% of us who didn't have to go to war in uniform, that we also had a part to play. But that was also true on the Democratic side. They weren't out there beating the drum and saying that we've all got to step forward here. So that was a missed opportunity, in my judgment.
You write about service in your book, that we need to remember John Kennedy's question, ask not what you can do, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, that you propose in the book a really substantive national service kind of program.
Yes, I think that wherever I go in America, people say, should we bring back the draft? Can we have some kind of mandatory national service? I try to strike, I suppose, the middle note here. We're not going to bring back the draft. The Army doesn't want it. They like the motivation of the volunteers who are there. It's a political kind of a time bomb when you're going to unpopular wars. So I propose that we have 6 public service academies across America attached to land-grant schools, and they become public-private partnerships. You have the Johnson & Johnson Fellow in medicine, and that's not just physicians, but nurse practitioners and medical technicians. The John Deere Fellow in agriculture, which is going to be an ever more important part of our future and our economy. The Caterpillar Fellow in construction. And the both postgraduate and entry-level but skill set intense programs turn out these young people who served their country either abroad or here during something like Katrina or the tornado in Joplin, Missouri. And they do that for 3 years. And then at the end of 3 years, they go back to their sponsoring company for a 2-year kind of test drive and prove themselves. And they either stay in the company or after 2 years, they're gone. I just think that we need to have some big, bold ideas. AmeriCorps and the Peace Corps and the Teach for America programs all have kind of record enrollments at the moment, but we need something to tie all that together so we become more than the sum of our parts as we dive into the 21st century.
Thanks for the call, Kelly. Joe and Custer, hi.
Hello. I'd like to go back to Korea again and think about how high their standard of living has come since 1950 and how much we've been involved. I mean, there are 200 million Chinese who have gone from poverty to middle class because of what's happened. And we're actually more involved in the world than we were in World War II, destroying things, but there's no plan of controlling, you know, how the incomes of the rest of the world can be raised and ours kept the same.
Tom?
Well, I think that's a very relevant point. We have to think about what is our role in the world at the moment, and it's no fault of the warriors because they have been sent there. We've been fighting the 2 longest wars in our nation's history in Afghanistan and in Iraq. It has had a radiant effect on that part of the world. And so the face of America has been militarized to a large degree. Meanwhile, the Chinese are all over Africa and all over South America making deals with governments and tribes and local fiefdoms, extracting the natural resources, building roads, and establishing a presence to try to keep up with big challenge that they have at home, which is to try to provide an economy for 1.4 billion people, many of whom will be moving to the cities in the next 100 years or so. And so their challenges are substantial as well, but they're not spending a lot of their resources at the moment on fighting wars in distant places.
Let's spend a few moments talking about President Obama and your interview with him in Germany, and your advice to him that he walk the beaches of Normandy and prepare to feel his knees buckle. And as a journalist, you're being on to the next story, the next story, the next story. But for this one, you were struck by his youth, what lay in front of him, and also the past, because there you were in Germany telling him to go to Normandy.
Well, it really was an intersection of history and certainly of my own life. There was an African-American young president of the United States in Dresden, which had been firebombed to within an inch of its life at the end of World War II, and then lived behind the communist lines for the next 45 years. He was going to Dachau, which is one of the most notorious camps of the Holocaust, and from there to Normandy, the site of the greatest military invasion in history, which really was the beginning of the end for the Nazi Empire. And then he was coming home to essentially a broken American economy. And I thought, think about the confluence of all of these events. History really teaches us lessons every day. And so as I thought about these challenges, I also thought back to the time when my parents and other members of that generation really struggled through the Great Depression, when life was all about deprivation and sacrifice, and then they were asked to put on uniforms and go thousands of miles across the Pacific and thousands of miles across the Atlantic to fight the two greatest military machines that had ever been assembled. We were not really prepared. We had trainees who were using wooden rifles and close-order drills. We were inventing airplanes and new weapons on the run, but we prevailed and made it. So I thought, will that spirit be prevalent in the 21st century? We look back on that generation and we realize what their legacy is. 50 years from now, what historians will look back on our generation and this time, and what will they say is our legacy?
Mm-hmm. You write, Tom, between January of 2007 and January of 2011, 9 million workers lost jobs. Untold numbers of others took pay cuts, were furloughed, are working part-time. Tell me, what is, and have you heard from anybody, what the next big idea is to help all of those people?
Well, I think there are a number of them, but they haven't been consolidated into one big idea yet, and that's part of the problem, because this is, in some ways, not a shake-and-bake issue that we have to deal with. We have exported so much of our manufacturing jobs. Part of the hope is that as China has to pay higher income, some of those jobs will come back here because we can compete at the wage level. Another piece of it is that we have to train, let me get back to the education part of it now, we have to train workers for the new demands of the modern economy. So many modern manufacturers in America, and they're still here, will say, you know, we get a workforce that comes out of high school and they can't do basic math, or they don't. They need remedial training in literacy.
Right.
As a result, community colleges across America, and I'm confident that's the case in Wisconsin as well, are booming because they've kind of retooled themselves to meet the demands of the modern workforce. They're economically efficient. They're affordable. They're sometimes just a year-long or a two-year-long course. You get somebody coming out of high school who doesn't want necessarily to go to a four-year college. A community college is a good answer. So we have to, I think, address as well in looking at the future of education the kind of system that we have in place to meet the demands of the modern economy.
Mm-hmm. Ken is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. It's an honor to speak to both of you. Regarding your last comment and also from your last book, what do you see as the reason that the greatest generation was able to win as many Nobel Prizes as they did, have such great success as they did, with an educational system that had really no money at all? And what does that mean for us currently with our economic problems going forward?
Well, Well, you know, part of the reason that the Greatest Generation did well was beginning with the GI Bill, which was a brilliant idea that Congress came up with and President Roosevelt came up with before the end of the war. So these young men and women who were coming back from the war had higher educational opportunities they could not have imagined before the war. And that lifted this country in so many ways. We were also kind of a solitary industrial power in the world because Western Europe had been so devastated, and so had Japan. So we, you know, we had a real head start going there. Now, what you find are the heads of the major academies in America, MIT or Cal Berkeley or Caltech or University of Wisconsin, they'll tell you that what we have to do, work harder at, is attracting a global population and keeping them here. We still have the best higher education institutions in the world, but we're making it harder and harder for, say, a Chinese or an Indian graduate in biosciences or in the hard physics to stay here. And when they do stay, they're inclined to start businesses and make real contributions to the country. So education is going to be the currency of the 21st century, and we just have to understand that. That's going to be the economic power and provide the national security that we've all grown accustomed to.
Who did you reference in the book? I can't remember who said that those people who do so well in those areas from foreign countries, give them a green card for graduation.
Well, it was actually a speaker at the Aspen Institute conference,
right,
a couple,
yeah,
of years ago. A lot of times those conferences don't produce much in the way of solutions. They're mostly just about a lot of people getting together and exchanging the same old ideas. But that idea was you put an immigration officer at the end of a stage at MIT or at the University of Wisconsin or any of the Big Ten schools, and the foreign student who's graduating with a degree in sciences, you stand there and you clip a green card to his or her diploma as they walk off stage and say, "Welcome to America, we need your help." Because we're training these people, but they're going back to compete against us now. They used to want to stay, and we made room for them to stay, but now so many of them can go back to Mumbai or going back to Brazil now. Russian students are on a kind of a two-way trip ticket to go back to Russia because there's an economy for them to make some money in, and they're doing it.
Thanks, Ken, for your call. Jean in Wauwatosa. Hi, Jean.
Hi, good morning. Sorry to go back to this. We've had much more interesting conversation but my comment really was inspired when you were talking about Congress. And I had seen that 60 Minutes piece this past week by Steve Croft on how they are almost using insider trading information, mm-hmm, to benefit their portfolio. And I really thought, well, maybe this is why Representative Ryan doesn't want to run for president, if he can make so much more money. And I didn't know if either of you saw that, but
I did see that. Yeah. Did you see it, Tom?
Yeah, and I am familiar with it. I can't comment on any specific cases. You know, there's been denial on the part of Speaker Pelosi and, mm-hmm, and John Boehner and others. But there are very, very strict kind of conditions on appointees to cabinet post. I happen to know the new Commerce Secretary, John Bryson is his name, and he had to clean out his portfolio, in effect, before he could take that job. And it's an enormous financial sacrifice for him. He couldn't put it in a blind trust. But this stuff spills over to Congress now in a way that, you know, members of their family can make investments, and it's not just that. It's the kind of, I suppose, corporate welfare that they enjoy in terms of speaking at big organizations and getting free airplane rides to wherever they want to go and doing what they want to do. They've tightened up considerably, but there still is a kind of cheek-by-jowl relationship, if you will. I think we have to be careful, however, that we don't want to get just extraordinarily wealthy people in Congress who don't have to worry about what their long-term benefits are going to be. And we have to find a way through this maze of conflicts so that people can not have to give up all of their money to go to Washington, but when they're in Washington, we have to have much more transparency about where their investments are and have inviolate blind trust. So they put their investments in the hands of somebody, and they don't have anything to do with it while they're in power.
Thank you, Gene, very much for the call. Maybe this is just what I'm thinking about lately, but let's go back to this idea of how much is enough, because there are so many different parts of the book. I love the part where you invited people who had grown up in small towns to come to dinner at your house, because some of them were real hot shots, you know, making a lot of money. And you have a unique perspective because you've known all these people. You know people who are Wall Street brokers. You know people in Congress. You know people who... And you made a lot of money as an anchor. How do you get people who are in a privileged money class to start asking that question, how much is enough, and what difference does it make if I'm making a billion? What about that homeless person I see on the street as I drive next to him in my Mercedes?
Well, by and large, I think that these are individual decisions. For Wall Street guys, money is a scorecard. It's not just the fact that they're piling up the dough. It's how they keep score about how well that they've done in their particular job. Listen, I've been very fortunate. I've been paid more by NBC than I could have imagined when I was starting out. That has allowed me to have more things than I could have imagined. But we are constantly asking ourselves at this stage in our lives, my wife and I, and having this conversation with our children, it's need versus want. And do we need this, or do we just want it? So we have made a turn in our own lives about need versus want. And our kids, because they live in San Francisco and New York, which are very expensive places, are forced to make those decisions, and that's just fine every day. Because the cost of housing is so great, the cost of education is so great, and they're looking downstream about what they're going to do when it comes to higher education, and that's so expensive. I do think that every family should probably have that conversation. We're always going to have a certain amount of homelessness in this America, and it's not just a matter of writing a check and handing it over. We need to think about the construct of our social services program to make sure that they're taken care of in the way that they ought to be. And every family has to decide for themselves what their philanthropic endeavors are going to be. We happen to be very active. I don't want this to sound as immodest as it might, but it's always been one of the most rewarding parts of our life is that we're able to not just send a check, but we like getting involved. My wife ran a homeless shelter in New York, and she now has got a book club at a charter school up in Harlem, and one of my daughters is very active in Habitat for Humanity, and that gives a richness to our lives that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Right. Yeah, it sure does. Tell me a little bit more, before we go back to phone calls, about your mom. Are you a journalist because your mom wanted to be one and couldn't?
Yes. By the way, I just lost my mother last week. And
Oh, Tom, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that.
Yes, and that's okay, because we're utterly at peace with it. She had a fantastic life. She went from learning to read by the kerosene lamp to logging on. She went from driving a team of horses to traveling the world, on luxury cruise liners that we sent her on, or on jet plane tours of Europe. She had an amazing life. She did want to be a journalist. Her father was a bookish man, my grandfather. They lived on a tiny farm out in South Dakota, but they read the encyclopedia and the great works of literature. Mm. And when Mother graduated from high school at 16, college cost $100 a year. She couldn't go. She wanted to be a journalist. She became the next best thing. She worked at the post office in the small towns where we lived. And in a way, she became the managing editor of the community because she would hear the stories that defined the town's daily activities and the lives of the people. And she would bring them home to me at night. And I would sit there at age 10 or 11, and I'd be all ears to know about what she had seen. And as I was coming of age, we would talk about the news and watch the news together. So she really did steer me, I think, in that direction.
What did she think about your life?
You know, she had a great kind of Midwestern perspective on it. I once wrote a book called A Long Way From Home about the first 22 years of my life. I sent it to her to just kind of make sure that it was all right. She wrote back. She said, "It's mostly fine, dear, but of course your ego is showing in a lot of places." And that broke up all my friends because they knew her. And that's exactly, she would cut to the chase as quickly as anybody I knew. And when somebody would talk about Tom's great success, she would immediately switch the conversation to my brother Mike or my brother Bill because she didn't want it to get out of proportion.
Oh, well, except my condolences. That's a hard loss. I'm sure it's a hard loss for you.
She did, but she never, she had a great heart, and she never complained about anything. She was at the ranch a year ago, and She was not doing well, but we would talk in the morning about what life was like on the farm, and then they lost her to the Depression. And she just wanted to remember the good times. She wanted to remember the kind of the socials with the local farmers, where they would get together on Sundays, and the men would have a shoe lathe, and they would repair shoes, and the women would do quilting. And they were all pulling together in some fashion. They talked about how hard it was to make ice cream, because they'd have to go to town to get a big block of ice and save that and chip it and then hand crank it. But she said when we were all done, it was so delicious. So, you know, there were payoffs to all that. By the way, her family all kind of began in Wisconsin. They were part of that great northern migration route of a lot of Irish Americans who stopped on the railroad in Wisconsin and Sun Prairie and Darlington and places like that before they got to St. Paul. Then they got to the Northern Prairie of South Dakota.
Yeah. You have the clock, the family clock that's been in your family for 100 years, and I like the way you started with a tick-tock, tick-tock. But the importance of our remembering the stories that your mother and her parents told, that we tell our children those stories, because tick-tock, before you know it, it's another decade, it's another time, and we need to fashion our own lives to remember what came before.
Yeah, I use the clock as a metaphor for, as a kind of silent witness to history. It came into our family around the turn of the 20th century. My dad's family had a small railroading hotel in the northern part of the state, a pretty hard scrabble operation where the working class and the Swedish homesteaders would stay, and they had a big family dining room. I actually lived in it for a time when I was very young. And this clock was in the living room, and then it came into our family, and we've had it forever. Very handsome piece. And I thought, think of all it's seen. You know, it saw the arrival of electricity and telephones and railroads and World War I and the Great Depression and World War II, the atomic age, Vietnam, counterculture, assassinations of John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Dr. King. And it's just tick-tock, tick-tock. It's a silent witness and a reminder, to me at least, and to our family, that we got through all of that. But we got through all of that by, you know, acknowledging how difficult it was to be, is going to be, to take the next step forward. But we did it, and we did it with imagination, and we did it with boldness, and we did it without giving up our individual political philosophies, but finding a way to work together. And that's been kind of lost, I'm afraid.
Tom Brokaw, our guest. The book is The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America, Who We Are, Where We've Been, and Where We Need to Go Now to Recapture the American Dream. Our number is 800-486-8655. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow at 9 on our program, the recall effort in Wisconsin has begun. We will talk about it during our first hour of tomorrow's show. Tom Brokaw is our guest now, and let's go to Helen in Sheboygan. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I would like to ask Tom Brokaw and you as well, how are we ever going to get back to revitalizing the American dream unless we have campaign finance reform? I'm 77, and I've been political since I was probably 12 years old and very involved in things like the League of Women Voters, and I'm not an ideologue, but we can't do anything until we get money out of campaigning. And how do you do that when the only people who can change this are the people who are getting the money? I mean, there's
that's a good question.
No way.
That's a very, very perceptive question.
Right.
It gets at the heart of a lot of the difficulties that we're having right now and trying to have real communication within our political parties. Because these big contributions finance very narrow interest, and unless a candidate hews to that very narrow interest, they don't get the money that they feel they need to run their campaigns. Campaigns get ever more expensive. They finance political operatives who are a little more than hired guns, who come in with the mantra of kill and kill again and then just leave the state or the community after the campaign is over. And you're quite right. The change will only come from the people who are the beneficiaries of all of this. So here's something that may surprise people. You know, the best example I know of a ground-up populist movement that's had real impact in American politics, like it or not, is the Tea Party. They got angry, they got organized, they got to Washington, they've stayed on message, they've stayed disciplined, and I think that they probably at the moment have more power than their numbers would indicate. I think it's out of proportion to their raw numbers if you look at all the national polling. But you have to give them credit because they played by the rules and they said, you know, this will not stand in our judgment. And so they're driving the dialogue on the Republican side at the presidential candidate level. And if you want to change it, you've got to get like-minded people who can form a coalition and say, we're going to force the parties to develop their own rules. Because it's pretty clear that in this court, the Supreme Court is inclined to think of money as another expression of free speech, either at the corporate or individual level. So you're not going to get legal rulings that will probably hold up. It's going to have to be systematic from within the political structure. That will only come if there's a demand from the masses of the people.
Mm. What do you think of the Occupy movement, Tom?
Well, I think it's you know, it was interesting when it started. I couldn't quite figure out where it was going to go, and I don't think it ended up with much of a destination because it didn't have a central unifying theme except Occupy, camping out in Zuccotti Park and in New York. I was in Chicago recently and went by the Federal Reserve, and there were only about 25 of the demonstrators out there saying, honk your horn if you don't like Wall Street. So it was pretty unclear to a lot of folks about just what it was that they were trying to do. There were signs for demanding everything from free medical education to free higher education, to some labor members as well, who were speaking out against the new restrictions that have been attempted in some states, including yours, notably,
mm-hmm.
on the role of public unions. But it didn't have central leadership in a way, and it didn't get itself, I suppose the best way of describing it, it didn't get itself to the next level, and therefore it's kind of dribbling away at the moment.
Helen, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Jackie in Sun Prairie. Hi, Jackie.
Hello there. I am a longtime teacher, and I've just retired. And I've been in Wisconsin for, you know, all my life, and have taught in two school districts, one in northern Wisconsin and in southern Wisconsin, and have seen a wide variety of students and teachers in my post-retirement when I worked as an ad hoc professor in education. And one of the things that strikes me again and again is the strengths of the generations that I taught, the strength of the people in the generations. Sure, there's a lot of silliness in high school students, and then there's a lack of focus, and certainly there's a lot of entitlement right now with a lot of students. But I've found that I think when it gets tough, as the old cliche goes, the tough get going. And I think the great generation of my parents and your parents, they were in a situation where they simply had to. My father did not go off to war in World War II. Rather, he took care of his six parentless brothers and sisters and stayed on the farm. I asked him many times, why didn't you go off on your own? And he said, well, somebody had to do it, and we did it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I honestly think that you're onto something. I think they're calling this new generation coming of age now, coming out of college with a lot of debt, or maybe their parents have lost a job, or their house is underwater, as they say these days. The marketers have a new phrase for them. They call them the neo-frugalists. They're looking at life in a much different way. I think it's 40% of the college graduates are moving back home. A, they can't afford the rents in the workplace. B, they don't have a job. And C, they trust their families for guidance. And
yes.
So they move back home to kind of get oriented about going into what we call the real world. They'll have an impact on the future shape of this country. They probably will have more values, and they probably will think about thrift in a different fashion, and they won't kind of be tempted by the highly leveraged economy in which we end up with so much debt. So at the moment, they're kind of out there perusing the landscape. They're a work in progress, and we'll see where they go.
Mm. The other, I love your reminiscences of people too, of people like Bart Giamatti I read that to my husband yesterday, who was having his knee replaced as I was reading your book in the hospital, and he loved Bart Giamatti because he's a baseball reporter. And there are people that you carry with you that I just love the fact that you do that. You also followed his advice. Yeah, you're not expected to know, but you're expected to wish to know. By golly, do you ever wish to know, Tom Brokaw?
Well, Bar Giamatti was a great voice, and I still hear his voice in many ways. I used to, before I knew him, I collected his speeches. And just,
oh, did you?
Pardon me?
I just said, did you?
Yeah. You know, it was, we need more voices like that.
Yeah. Well, you're terrific. It's good to know that somebody who's such a deep thinker is sharing the world with us. Thank you so much. Thanks for writing the book. I liked it very much.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you all, and thanks. Say hello to everybody in Wisconsin.
All right. Tom Brokaw, our guest. The book is The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America, Who We Are, Where We've Been, and Where We Need to Go Now to Recapture the American Dream. Thanks for listening, everybody, and for your calls. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. And tomorrow we will be with you at 9 o'clock talking about the recall effort which has begun in Wisconsin. And we'll find something interesting to talk about, our number two as well. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.